Good afternoon, Your Honors. Colin Campbell for Appellant Lynn Atkinson. The issue as we see it is one of whether a plaintiff can accept a statutory offer after final judgment has entered on behalf of the defendant who made the offer. And I believe the jumping off point for the analysis is first whether this is a matter of first impression under Colorado law. We submit that it is, and we submit that recognizing that the plaintiff, as well as the trial court, recognized the Centric Jones versus Huffnagel decision as controlling precedent. We don't believe that that decision is controlling precedent, that it was actually more narrowly crafted than what the trial court considered. We believe the Centric majority opinion actually was quite precise in limiting the scope of its discussion to the facts that were presented in that case. And I'll just read one line from the decision in which the court described what the issue was that it was addressing. And that's at the top of page 6, but it reads, in listing the questions they are addressing, the second is the specific question, whether an offer of judgment automatically is revoked if, within the 10-day period, the trial court enters summary judgment in favor of one of the two defendants which made a joint offer of judgment pursuant to the statute. So the majority made clear that it was discussing this issue within the context of a summary judgment ruling that had not been made final, because under Rule 54 it did not address or conclusively resolve all of the issues involving all of the parties. And that was a point that was then clarified in Justice Erickson's concurring opinion, in which Justice Erickson went at some length to describe that because this was a summary judgment that had been entered only on behalf of one of the two defendants, that was an order that was subject to change and was not a final controlling judgment. There is no language in Centric Jones which addresses whether the statutory offer survives a final judgment. And I believe the implication from Justice Erickson's concurring opinion is at least from his standpoint, I don't think he believes it would have. So, if Centric Jones is not controlling, then what's the answer? We submit that the final judgment, having been entered by the trial court in behalf of Ms. Atkinson, means just that, that it is final, that it conclusively resolves the litigation in Ms. Atkinson's favor, so there's nothing left to address by the trial court, and therefore no opportunity for the plaintiff to then retroactively attempt to accept a statutory offer that had been made before final judgment entered.
Counsel, we're trying to interpret a statute here. I'm struggling to see where this exception that you're arguing for is contained in the words of the statute. It talks about when an offer or how long an offer is open. It's open for at least 14 days from the date of service unless withdrawn by service of withdrawal of the offer settlement. And the statute doesn't mention anything about terminating upon a final judgment. Where does that come from?
You're right, Your Honor. It does not mention it one way or the other. It doesn't say that it terminates upon entry of final judgment. It also doesn't say it survives upon entry of final judgment. So I don't think the answer can be found in the language of the statute itself.
You're asking us to add to the statute.
I don't believe so, no.
Well, if it's not there, then to find it somewhere, we have to add it.
Well, I think if the interpretation were to be that the statutory offer survives final judgment, I think that would be adding language to the statute that isn't found there either.
Well, wait a minute. This is a summary judgment. Settlements happen after summary judgments all the time. It's not as if the case is over and nothing can be done about it. The party lost summary judgment can appeal. That happens all the time. And a settlement can be entered into. That happens all the time.
I agree. But the mechanism of the statute...
But if you're right, then you can't even make an offer of settlement after summary judgment's been entered.
I agree. You cannot.
You can't. Okay.
You cannot.
Okay. Where does that come from?
Because there's no existing claims to be addressed. There is no ongoing litigation.
But there's an appeal. That's ongoing litigation.
Yes.
We're doing some today.
Correct.
So there's been no mandate issued. The outcome of the claims is in doubt. It could be reversed. It could be a trial.
I understand, and I will. Here is why the statutory offer would not apply to a case on appeal. Because the mechanism within the language of the statute calls for an accounting of whether a defendant is entitled to cost shifting to where they entitled to recover their costs rather than the plaintiff. And that accounting is to take place upon entry of final judgment. That language is in the statute, which means that once final judgment is entered, the equation is fixed. And at that point, the court is to address whether or not there has a cost shifting has taken place. And if that is to take place at the time of entry of final judgment, that means that the situation cannot be changed after that. And which also mean, and I have to confess, I hadn't thought of the example that you just gave until we're having this discussion this afternoon, but I would think arguably that means that a statutory offer made after final judgment and only for the purposes of appeal does not fit within the statutory scheme and would be of no effect.
Well,
and obviously the parties can settle or make settlement offers or informally. Not all settlement discussion has to take place within the context of the statutory offer. But the statutory offer as written contemplates an offer made during the litigation before the trial court and only up until the point the final judgment is entered.
So what if a party that loses on summary judgment appeals and is successful on appeal? So we're back down in the trial court. Would it be your position that you had a final judgment, but you don't have a final judgment anymore?
We're back on remand?
Yeah.
And I've lost summary judgment? Yes.
All right. So at that point, you can make an offer?
At that point, I could.
Okay. So, but there's this period while it's on appeal where you can't make an offer?
Not under this statutory scheme. Obviously, you can make a settlement offer. The parties can agree to settle at any point. But during that phase, when the case is on appeal, the statutory scheme simply doesn't apply. It wouldn't work because you don't have that determination of the final judgment to determine who wins or loses under the statutory offer cost-shifting provision.
Well, in other contexts, say, for instance, claim preclusion, we've held that there is no final judgment for purposes of claim preclusion until appeals have been exhausted if taken. I mean, it seems to me you're saying there's only one definition of final judgment, that is, when a judgment is final for purposes of appeal, but we've applied different definitions in different contexts.
I am basing my interpretation based on my reading of Rule 54, which, as I read it, does define when final judgment is entered. And when we apply that to the context of Justice Erickson's discussion and his concurring opinion in Cedric Jones, that was the definition he was using, that he was describing that the summary judgment remained unfinalized, if you will, and subject to change by the court because it was not yet a final judgment under Rule 54B. So I'm taking that analysis and taking it one step further and basically taking the corollary of that, saying, okay, if Justice Erickson is correct, and we believe it makes sense that he was, once final judgment does enter, then, you know, the final buzzer is sounded with regard to any determination within the court. And under the rules of civil procedure, once judgment enters, the only way that judgment can be altered is under Rule 59 motion. And Rule 59 is quite specific as to the criteria of what allows for the court to consider revising or withdrawing a judgment under Rule 59, and that was never requested in this case, and certainly these circumstances, to my mind, wouldn't fall within Rule 59 criteria.
Well, that raises an interesting hypothetical. Let's say the party who lost summary judgment files a timely Rule 59 motion. Now, the law is clear that as long as that Rule 59 motion is pending up to, I think, 60 days, the summary judgment order is not appealable to this court. It's not a final judgment. So you're saying it's final, and then it's unfinal. So we're kind of hopping back and forth. Is that what you're saying?
Hopefully not.
Well, it seems like it's final when summary judgment's entered. It then becomes not final when a timely Rule 59 motion is filed, but then it becomes final again if that's denied timely or the time period runs out.
I recognize these circumstances can appear arbitrary when parsed out, but I think that is precisely what the rules of procedure call for. Rule 54, again, is quite specific in saying that once judgment has entered that resolves all the claims between all the parties, that is a final appealable judgment. And the fact that a Rule 59 motion may then be filed obviously still invests the trial court with the jurisdiction to address that motion, and by the same token, it extends the time for the running of the deadline for a notice of appeal, but it doesn't change the fact that the final judgment has already been entered. See, that's really my point, that this is not so amorphous that you can have a final judgment and then not a final judgment. Once final judgment is entered, you have a final judgment, and my primary problem with the plaintiff's position is that if they're correct, then you would end up with multiple final judgments. One that was entered for the defendant at one point in time, and then a later one entered for the plaintiff at a subsequent time. And for the life of me, I don't see how the rules of procedure can be interpreted in a way that allows for entry of several final judgments at different points of time, one for the plaintiff and one for the defendant. But I think that is the inevitable result of adopting the plaintiff's position in this case. So hopefully I'm not being overly simplistic. I don't mean to be. But I do have to resort, when we go through these hypotheticals, to Rule 54 and my reliance on Rule 54 in telling us when a final judgment does indeed enter. And it tells us that as of the time that the trial court entered summary judgment, since it did resolve all the issues between the only two parties in the case, that is by every definition I've seen, that makes it a final judgment. And as a final judgment, under the statutory scheme for offers, that fixes the rights and responsibilities between the parties and determines whether or not there is a cost shifting. It certainly doesn't contemplate that occurring at some point later on. I'm certainly happy to answer any other questions. If there's none that you have at this time, I'll reserve my remaining time.
May it please the court. Excuse me. My name is Benjamin Sachs. My registration number is 11034. I'm appearing today on behalf of the appellee. We're asking the court to affirm the trial court's judgment and order enforcing a binding legal settlement agreement under the offer of settlement statute. There are, by my reckoning, only four possible ways that we can lose this appeal. The first is if the undisputed facts and the record revealed any revocation on the part of Ms. Atkinson under subdivision 1A5 of the statute. But that's not the case here. The record clearly indicates that there was an offer and an acceptance through the e-system that was filed with the court, and that occurred prior to any attempted withdrawal or revocation of the offer. So that's out. The second way is that if there's some intervening decision of the Supreme Court after the Supreme Court's decision in the Centric Jones case that had the effect of overruling it or changing the effect of that decision. Our position is that Centric Jones is good law. In fact, recently the Supreme Court, in a case called Ferrelgas Inc. versus Yeiser, had the occasion to specifically refer to the Centric Jones case, and and said this: the very foundation of Colorado's settlement framework relies on the conceptualization of settlement offers as ironclad, irrevocable promises to pay the offered settlement amount in exchange for the guarantee that the matter will be resolved and judgment will be entered. See Centric Jones versus Hufnagel. That is Ferrogas versus Yeiser, 247 P3rd at 1030. That was
Centric Jones. We did have a situation where it wasn't a summary judgment as to the entire case. Here we do.
That's obviously true. I was simply citing it to point out that quite recently the Supreme Court has cited to Centric Jones as good authority and for the premise that I just quoted. So there's no question that Centric Jones remains good law in Colorado, despite the fact that there have been some amendments to the underlying offer of settlement statute that really are not pertinent. The amendments are not pertinent in this case. Now, the third possible way would be if the Centric Jones case is somehow distinguished. And we would submit that the Centric Jones case is directly on point. There was a settlement offer that was made in that case on September 30th of 1992. There was a motion for summary judgment granted in October of 1992. Then subsequently, after entry of summary judgment, there was an acceptance. And the acceptance came within the statutory acceptance period. The Supreme Court majority held that that acceptance was good and had not been rendered ineffectual because of the intervening entry of summary judgment. Now, the pertinent facts in that case are really not distinguishable at all from this case. Same circumstances here. We have a pending offer of settlement under the statute that's made by the defendant. The defendant controlled the timing and the decision to extend that offer, to tender the offer of settlement under the statute, had the full ability to have only offered a non-statutory offer of settlement had she chosen to do so, but instead, intending to potentially bind the plaintiff to cost liability, made an offer of settlement pursuant to the statute. Then came the court's ruling on summary judgment, and then that was followed very shortly afterwards by a notice of acceptance pursuant to the statute that was filed with the trial court. And that, of course, came before any attempt to withdraw. Now, in that respect, our case is even stronger than Centric Jones because there was no attempt to withdraw the offer of settlement. Unlike in Centric Jones, there was no attempt to withdraw it here prior to acceptance. So essentially, the Supreme Court's rationale was that having the full authority to extend a statutory offer of settlement, that the defendant cannot just simply say that it's ineffectual and of no consequence, that the defendant offeror has to take the bitter with the sweet.
Mr. Sachs, excuse me, how do you respond to Mr. Campbell's assertion that the distinction between Centric Jones and this case is the difference between a final judgment here and not a final judgment in the Centric Jones case because of the two defendants in summary judgment entered for only one?
Well, that's the fourth possibility, that the court decides to graft onto this clear and unambiguous statutory scheme an exception based on some novel conceptualization of a final judgment, where there's absolutely no language in the controlling statute that would support doing so. So we would submit that doing so would just simply violate settled principles and rules of statutory interpretation, including the one that Judge Jones alluded to, that the court cannot write additional language or graft additional language into a clear and unambiguous statute.
What do you make of Justice Erickson's concurring opinion then? Do you simply say that's just one justice's opinion and we can ignore it because the majority doesn't use that rationale?
You know, I think that Justice Erickson, as occasionally occurs, was addressing a fine point that he felt worthy to elaborate on in what was essentially a concurring opinion that substantially agreed with the majority opinion. But that wasn't a distinction that really mattered or was of any significance to the majority in that case. So we don't think that it has any teeth to it. There's another problem, and that is that it's not simply that there's no language or authority at all for grafting this concept onto this clear and unambiguous statute, and that it would violate settled principles of statutory interpretation. But finality has different meanings in different contexts. It's not a concept that has a single settled meaning. So I think that during the dialogue that you just had with opposing counsel reveals that he's not really even proffering any clear definition of finality that should apply here, much less why it should apply. You know, here, I think that the court should just simply reject the notion that there is this unwritten finality exception to the statute. There's no authority for it. There's no language that supports it.
Well, counsel, let me ask you, do you agree then with your opponent or not that you can't make a statutory offer of settlement after there's been a final judgment through way of summary judgment?
I think that the language of the statute is clear that you can make an offer. You can make an offer of settlement under the statute at any time prior to 14 days before trial. Now, I think it's also important to reflect on the fact that the court, in its proceedings after summary judgment, indicated that its decision was not all that final, and in fact it was tentative, because in the sense that the court was expecting a motion for reconsideration. And that was obviously, it was obviated by the existence of the settlement agreement.
But that's just musings of the court. I mean, it either is or is not a final judgment. Whether the court thinks that some party's going to file a Rule 59 motion or not, that doesn't, what the court thinks about that doesn't change whether it's final or not.
I would give more credence to what the court said, especially when it said that I also did not vacate the trial date, because I expected that I would be in a position to reconsider. And the only reason that there was no reconsideration was essentially that the summary judgment was extinguished by the settlement agreement. And I want to address that point, because I think you were alluding to the Carpenter versus Young case decided by the Supreme Court. In that case, which is P 2nd at 568 to 569. The court actually specifically addressed what happens when there's a settlement agreement after an entry of summary judgment. And the court said, we turn next to the issue of whether the summary judgment order entered in Keeler's favor merged into and was extinguished by the settlement agreement. The general rule is that a settlement agreement supersedes a judgment. And so long as the agreement exists, the judgment merges into it. So the operative judgment here is the final judgment by the court enforcing the settlement agreement pursuant to the offer of settlement statute, where clear authority is conferred on the court to do just what it did. And we believe that by operation of the rule in Carpenter, this essentially vitiated and extinguished the pre-existing summary judgment. The only reason that we brought a conditional cross appeal in this case was on the slight possibility that this court would somehow decide that the final judgment based on a binding settlement agreement was somehow not valid. So, and in fact, our request is that you do not consider the conditional cross appeal and the issues that are raised in it because it's unnecessary. And if Carpenter v. Young is correct, it signifies that the settlement agreement essentially extinguished the pre-existing summary judgment order. So even if it weren't tentative, which we submit that it was, as evidenced by the judge's own language, that it still was extinguished by operation of the settlement agreement, actually just by the settlement agreement, not even by the subsequent judgment that was entered enforcing the settlement agreement. The court's language here, citing several cases, says that it's the settlement agreement itself that has the effect of extinguishing the summary judgment.
But that all presupposes that the settlement agreement isn't terminated by operation of law. If it was terminated by operation of law, as your opponent argues, then no, then the summary judgment was not extinguished. So this is very circular.
Perhaps, but I think not. I think that there's no question but that the trial court had the authority conferred by the language of the statute to entertain the motion to enforce the settlement agreement at the time it did, and did just as the statute directed it to do. It found a legally binding settlement agreement based on essentially ministerial facts that would have been evident to the clerk. The offer of settlement, the notice of acceptance, boom, settlement agreement. So we think that the court, for all of these reasons, has to affirm the trial court's entry of judgment and its ruling that there was a legally binding settlement agreement pursuant to the statute. And also we would ask that you hold that the Centric-Jones decision is good law and it's controlling precedent in this case. Thank you. If you don't have any further questions, I'll end at this point.
Thank you.
Just a brief comment or two. I'm not suggesting that Centric-Jones is not good law. It is good law. It just simply addressed a different set of circumstances of what we have here. And when Mr. Sachs said that the difference between a partial summary judgment and a final judgment didn't matter to the majority opinion in Centric-Jones, we don't know that. In fact, I would suggest that it did matter, and that's why the court was quite as careful as it was to carefully structure the issue that it was addressing to reflect just the facts of the case. And I don't think there's any language in there that would suggest that they attempted to broaden that or intended to broaden the scope of their opinion to address matters where there was a final judgment. Mr. Sachs suggested that we have been less than clear in our definition of finality. Hopefully that's not the case. I've tried to be as clear as I can in suggesting we actually do know where the dividing line is and that Rule 54 is what provides that to us. And I don't think there is any question but that the summary judgment entered in this case did comprise a final judgment under Rule 54. And I really haven't heard any explanation either in the plaintiff's briefing or in their oral argument this afternoon really that would suggest otherwise. With that, I think I'll end unless there are any further questions.
Mr. Sachs seems to argue that the Carpenter case would provide otherwise as to the summary judgment being a final judgment in the face of a statutory settlement offer. How do you respond to that?
And I apologize, I'm at a disadvantage. I'm not familiar with that decision. It wasn't one that was contained within their briefing and not one that I reviewed for the purposes of preparing for this afternoon. I don't know what that holding was or what the facts were. And so I don't have a position here this afternoon as how it might apply or not apply to the issues we're dealing with.
Thank you.
Thank you to both counsel for your arguments this afternoon. This case will stand submitted. We will get you a written opinion in due course.